This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Drought and civil war are decimating the African nation of Somalia. The International Committee of the Red Cross estimates that as many as one-third of the nation's people will die in the next 6 months without additional relief. The war is making it difficult for shipments of food and medicine to get to their destinations. Relief convoys are in constant danger of being attacked by armed gangs. My guest, Rakia Omar, just returned from visiting Somalian refugee camps on the Ethiopian border. Omar is the executive director of the human rights group Africa Watch. She is Somalian and has lived in England since the age of 13. We asked her to help us understand what the civil war is about. But first, I wanted to know about Omar's trip to refugee camps. I asked her if she saw anything she was unprepared for.
Well, for me, it was the first visit to a refugee camp where the overwhelming majority of the people are literally dying of starvation right in front of you. I have never been somewhere where by the hour people are dying, especially small children, where you have skeletal women who are forced to decide which of their children get supplementary feeding with the hope of surviving, while they themselves are on the verge of collapse from hunger. I found it an extremely painful trip. I went there primarily to get information about the human rights abuses in southern Somalia that made these people flee their homes. But it was actually impossible to ask people who are just dying of hunger right in front of you to describe what happened 3 weeks ago or a month ago when they started this painful journey to come to Ethiopia. So I was unprepared for the sight of so many hungry people, and I was unprepared for the impact it would have on me. I felt I had seen a lot of human suffering because of my work, but just being in a camp where you are only surrounded by people who are just dying, it was an extremely inhuman experience for me.
Is there no food in the area, or is it just hard to get food to the people?
Well, the one of the camps I went to, Dolo, is on the border between Kenya, Somalia, and Ethiopia. It's extremely isolated. It is being affected by drought, which has affected the whole region. There are no services. It's extremely dusty. It is an extremely underdeveloped part of the world to begin with. And for them to cope with so many people coming over the border was just overwhelming when the region is itself suffering drought. So they have a lot of internally displaced people, as well as former Ethiopian refugees returning from Somalia. So there are all those three categories. But by all accounts, the most in distress are the newly arrived refugees from Somalia. And when I say newly arrived, people were arriving in the camp when I was there. And, you know, in the 1 hour, they would be beseeching you to convey their needs and their anger. And half an hour later, they would be leaving to go and bury the latest person that has died. And the combination, it was just very, very distressing.
You were saying that you were just unable to talk to people about the human rights abuses that forced them to flee. Were you able to find out anything about that, though?
Yes, I was, but and I did ask them, and they detailed the killings and the rape and the burning of their homes, the destruction of their agricultural base, because most of the people in that particular camp and in the Ethiopian camps are peasants that are fleeing the riverbed area in southern Somalia between the Juba and Shabelle rivers, which have traditionally been the breadbasket of the southern region. And they are clearly people who are not used to fleeing their homes. They're not nomads as most of the rest of the population of Somalia is. This is very much a settled population, and you could see their lack of familiarity with having to leave their homes, because they were clearly so ill-prepared in terms of, you know, the lack of utensils that that characterized their lives in the camps, and just their demeanor was just so appalling that you could tell these were not people who had, you know, had to get up and leave many times before.
Is it soldiers who are doing the raping and looting, or is it more kind of freelance people who've gotten their hands on arms? Is it just more the anarchy in general?
Well, I think it was probably started by some soldiers, but at this stage it's really degenerated to anyone, especially young men, who can get their hands on a gun. And that getting hold of a gun is easier than getting hold of a bowl of rice or an aspirin. So the country, thanks to the Cold War and thanks to the United States and the Soviet Union, is awash with armaments.
You say that because the United States and the Soviet Union supplied arms to Somalia over the years.
Well, they supplied the former dictator Siad Barre for 21 years, first the Soviet Union, and the last decade before his fall, the United States, because Somalia at that time had strategic significance as a Cold War ally.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Rakia Omar. She's the executive director of the human rights group Africa Watch, and she's speaking to us from London. I think it's been very hard for many Americans to put the Civil War into some kind of larger context. So let me ask you to help us understand why what is happening now is happening in Somalia. Let's get first to the two main factions that are fighting each other. One is led by the president, Muhammad Ali Mahdi, and the other is led by General Muhammad Farah Adid. Now, they both belong to the same clan, and they both belong to the same movement. So what exactly are they fighting about?
It's a power struggle between two men who each want power only for themselves. There are no ideological differences between them. As you've stated, there are no clan differences, and they belong to the same rebel movement. But each of them is so hungry for power that they are willing, and they have succeeded in destroying their people and their country. It is purely a mania for power that does not distinguish them, but that characterizes them both, but which has... which characterizes their struggle.
You say that there's really no government or civilian structure in Somalia now to mediate the conflict. Why is there no government or civilian structure?
Well, because after Siad Barre fled, the country more or less was near to collapse by that time, because it wasn't a situation where, there was a putsch and he was overthrown from one night to the next. There was a very, very long and debilitating struggle to overthrow him within the capital for at least a good a year and a half, I would say. That started in July 1989 with the riots in the capital, and in the countryside it was for much longer. So all of the national resources, so to speak, energy, human and financial resources, had gone into this struggle to overthrow Siad Barre. And the idea was then to restructure the civilian government as soon as he left. But then the nation was plunged into this factional fighting through the action of Ali Mahdi, which made all the groups fear that everything they had fought for had been lost. And now they were going to have to do the same thing, only under against a different man. So it completely destroyed any confidence that anyone might have had that that kind of fighting is now over, and the next fighting should be one of dialogue, one of debate, and there was simply no confidence in the government that put itself in place, that was concentrating all its energies on fending off everybody else and in not providing services, which after all is what a government is supposed to do.
You mentioned that many of the arms being used in the civil war in Somalia are arms that were supplied to Somalia by the Soviet Union or the United States during the dictatorship of Siad Barre. These are arms that are now being used in Mogadishu. They're being used in the middle of a city, but they're not really weapons that were designed for a city. I mean, these are weapons that were designed for field combat, right?
Yes. Well, they're not only being used in Mogadishu, they're being used everywhere in the country. A lot of the armaments that have destroyed the city of Mogadishu, as well as other cities, I may add, and also in the war in the north in 1988, are something that is called a technical, which is an anti-aircraft that is loaded off to the back of a civilian car, and lots of other heavy armaments that are intended for combat between two armies in the field. But, you know, if that's what people are going to use to achieve narrower ends, that's what they're going to achieve. I mean, it's the same thing now. If you watch what's happening in Yugoslavia, people aren't just fighting with small guns. They're fighting with, you know, mortars and artillery shelling. That seems to have become the new reality in civil wars.
It's one of the tragic ironies of the situation in Somalia that the dictator, Siad Barre, finally falls after 21 years, and instead of a democratic government taking over, it's civil war. I mean, the tragedy really begins after the dictator falls. Maybe we could talk about why that's happened. Let's talk about Siad Barre first. Now, his plan was to transform as quickly as possible Somalia into a modern socialist state. What exactly was he trying to do?
What he was trying to do was to set up a structure in which he would have all the power. His idea of a modern state was a socialist country, and his understanding of socialism was simply because what was not one that he had really thought through. Because if he had thought it through, he would have realized that it was wholly inappropriate for a country where the overwhelming percentage of the population is nomadic, is illiterate, does not live in the cities. But because he had become an ally of the Soviet Union in an effort to get weapons and economic support, that was the quid pro quo. He was going to adopt the political system that they themselves had accepted. So the idea that, you know, he comes, he takes power in 1969 and without any popular consultations, without any evidence that this is what the people of Somalia want, to impose from above his idea of a socialist state was wholly inappropriate and set the stage for the problems that then developed for the next two decades.
What was his problem with tribes? Too much of a threat to him?
Oh, he didn't have a problem with tribes, because whatever the rhetoric, he was the ultimate practitioner of the worst kind of tribalism. Somalia was regarded, ironically, as the most homogeneous country in Africa, because it's one of the few countries where which did not have ethnic blocs like you have in most other African countries and elsewhere in the world, where everyone spoke the same language, had the same culture, spoke the same language, had the same religion and the same culture. And the distinctions were essentially along clan lines. What Siad Barre wanted was, because he came from a small clan that was relatively underprivileged in terms of access to education and to economic opportunities, his rhetoric was to say that he wanted to eliminate tribalism, because this was an embarrassment to a country that wanted to move forward into the 20th century as a socialist state. And presumably his Soviet advisors told him that tribalism didn't go hand in hand with socialism. So that was what he said. But he practiced the most divisive and manipulative form of tribalism by entrenching his own family, his own tribe, at every level. And he then moved beyond his tribe, the Marehan, to other clans that are related to his own. And anyone who didn't belong to those tribes, for the most part, was at a disadvantage and essentially had to buy political loyalty.
And among the things that he did, I believe, was to outlaw private funerals and private weddings. What was the reason for that? To prevent clan gatherings?
Oh, yes, absolutely. To prevent people from having any opportunity for, you know, any kind of community of identity that was not entirely at the control of the government. Because what he did as soon as he came to power was to set up a whole paraphernalia that is very similar to Cuba, you know, where you have neighborhood committees, which on paper sound very nice, in the sense that they're supposed to encourage, you know, a sense of community at the neighborhood level, but actually turn out to just be spies and keeping an eye on each other and reporting people's movements and people's thoughts and people's actions to the authorities. He wanted to be able to control what people did at any moment, at work, at home, in public places, and therefore having you know, the opportunity to organize private funerals and weddings, etc., was clearly not acceptable because it would undermine the government's policy of being the only party that could control the nation.
My guest is Rakia Omar, Executive Director of Africa Watch. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Rakia Omar. She's the executive director of the human rights group Africa Watch. You've called 1991 the year that Somalia died. Why is it that when Siad Barre was driven from power, that a civil war began? What was the connection between those two events?
Well, I think that the tragedy about dictators who stay in power for so long is not just the harm they do in the years they are in power, but the near certainty that the longer they stay in power, the more devastating will be the fate of that country after they leave. You only have to look at Liberia as well to get a sense of that. We saw what happened in Romania shortly after Ceausescu fell. In the case of Somalia, it has gone much further than in either of those countries. I think part of the reason it's gone on for so long is the complete neglect of the country by the outside forces. And once their hunger became a serious problem, fighting became the only way that people could, people felt that they had the certainty of getting some food into their mouth. And this, of course, then just accelerates the breakdown, increases the tensions, makes more people want to take arms into their hands because they too see it as the only way that they can protect themselves and get more food. And this, and it's just gone on in this spiral, and now we are where we are.
Do you think that most of the intellectuals have fled Somalia?
Oh, there's no question about the fact that they fled Somalia. They fled not only in the last 18 months, but ever since Siad Barre came to power. His attempts to impose socialism went hand in hand with a fiercely anti-intellectual sentiment, and he began to remold the educational structure with the in line with his own political beliefs. He was forcing civil servants and intellectuals to undergo a military training, and of course had the economy under strict government control. So all of these factors went hand in hand to begin a massive brain drain that began as early as the mid-70s.
So do you think that creates a real leadership vacuum too?
Oh, absolutely. Ironically, Somalia's leadership has fallen on the elders who are doing what they can to bring the sides together. To
this is the tribal elders you're talking about.
Yes, it's not just a few prominent tribal elders, but just people who are regarded as elders partly because of their age, partly because of their the respect they enjoy in the community. But age ends up being an important factor, and they have been the ones that have actually been playing a leadership role. I think Somalia's intellectuals have failed their people.
Failed by leaving?
They failed by leaving, and they failed by, to a large extent, by failing to take a deep interest in what was happening in their country and human rights, at the human rights level, I think, throughout the decade of the 80s. They failed to mobilize the international community as effectively as some other communities have done, and in getting assistance to their country. I think they could have done much more.
Aren't you one of the intellectuals who left Somalia, though? You're Somalian-born.
I am Somalian, and when I say the Somali intellectuals have failed their country, I didn't take myself out of that category.
You feel you failed your country by leaving?
Well, I'm not trying to excuse myself, but when I left, I that was a decision by my family for me to leave. I left at the age of 13, but I have no doubt in my mind that if people like me had gone back much sooner, we might have played a more constructive role. On the other hand, it's also, and I hope this part can be in the program, you know, going back to Siad Barre in the 80s, you know, was went along with a serious risk that you would be killed or shot. So I'm not sure what realistically people could do if they went back, because there was absolutely no opportunity for freedom of expression, freedom of association, speaking out on human rights abuses. But I think we all could have done much more to mobilize the international community around the agony of our country.
Rakia Omar is my guest. She's executive director of the human rights group Africa Watch. What would you like to see the United Nations do in Somalia?
I would like to see the United Nations draw up a program that is based on a realistic assessment of the situation on the ground rather than these blueprints they keep coming up with that are done in haste and that are drawn up in New York by people who know nothing about Somalia or who know nothing about the complex situation as it is on the ground. The United Nations cannot hope to bring lasting peace to Somalia immediately, but what it must do is to figure out a realistic stage-by-stage program. And the first stage is food, food, food. Flood the country with food. Some of that food will get to the people who need it. But this idea that the UN is now floating about an airlift is unrealistic. Some remote areas that cannot be reached any other way need an airlift, but an airlift is a dramatic example that will help the United Nations recoup some of its lost credibility in Somalia, but it is not an answer because no organization can put enough resources into airlifts on a sustained basis. They are simply too expensive and it is unnecessary because Somalia is a relief workers' paradise. Every single Somali can be reached within 100 miles of the sea. You can use sea lifts, you can use the roads, the people can be reached, but first and foremost, get the food in there, get it in there fast, and organize it in conjunction with the International Committee of the Red Cross, Save the Children Fund, and other people who know what they're doing and who know what they're talking about.
Do you still have family in Somalia?
Yes, I do.
How are they being affected by the civil war?
I have no idea because it's impossible to have any communication with them.
Some people have said that the United Nations has been using a double standard by focusing so much on Yugoslavia and not nearly as much on Somalia. Do you agree with the double standard argument?
There is absolutely no question, but that's true. But I would like to add that I think it is this constant comparisons between Somalia and Yugoslavia are ultimately a disservice to the people of both countries because it creates the impression that the world can only focus on one disaster at a time. And since the United Nations is doing so much in Yugoslavia, one can hardly blame them for not having the time or the resources to worry about Somalia. That's not true. The world has enough resources, enough creativity, enough human intelligence to come to the assistance of both peoples, and it's just a matter of political will.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
You're welcome.
Rakia Omar is the executive director of the human rights group Africa Watch. She spoke to us from London, where the group is headquartered. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.